could say, well, we all know that quantum gravity by itself is a really complicated and hard problem, and it seems very unlikely that the inclusion of dynamical matter will make the problem simpler, so why should we actually do that? So I would like to argue that if we want to construct a quantum theory of gravity that has anything to do with quantum gravitational dynamics in our universe, then we should really take into account matter degrees of freedom from the beginning, because I will show you that matter degrees of freedom can actually have a very severe impact on the microscopic gravitational dynamics. So, well, what's the motivation? Well, clearly, observationally, matter is a part of our universe. And the assumption that I will make here is that, of course, you could say that matter degrees of freedom are somehow low energy effective degrees of freedom that only emerge at low energies. And really, fundamentally, the only thing that is there is space-time excitations. But it seems in such an approach, it is very unlikely to actually get out the standard model with all this complicated structure of mixing matrices and all of that. So the assumption I will make here is that both matter and gravity degrees of freedom are actually fundamental microscopic degrees of freedom. And then what this means is that as soon as you have those, clearly as matter has energy and momentum, there is no way how it couldn't gravitate. So in other words, there is no way how you can switch off the interaction between gravity and matter. And to be a little bit more concrete, let me use a metric formulation and just write down a kinetic term for matter, such as here, so no further interaction terms. But this already does induce an interaction between gravity and matter, because from that term you can construct vertices with matter legs and graviton legs, and you can construct those with infinitely many graviton legs. So what this means is that in the renormalization group flow, you do have the following contributions. You have loops containing only matter with external graviton legs or external gravity fields, and you also have loops just containing metric fluctuations with external matter legs. So what this means is that the renormalization group flow in the matter sector will be the renormalization group flow in the gravity sector will be affected by matter loops, and the renormalization group flow in the matter sector will be affected by gravity loops. So there is no way to avoid this. And so really, a priori, if you want to study renormalization group flows in quantum gravity, then both gravity and matter matter, and there is really no way to a priori decide which of these degrees of freedom should be more or less important. So let me now use a few examples from standard quantum field theories to show you what in principle can happen when you include matter degrees of freedom in a gauge theory. So first, let me look at the example. If I want to look at the renormalization group flow towards the UV, and I'm interested in finding consistent UV completions. So the example here is Young-Mills theory, which of course has a good UV completion. It's asymptotically free. So its beta function here, if this is the blue curve, has a negative sign. Now what happens if you couple matter degrees of freedom to this gauge theory is that quarks actually change the slope of this beta function until it becomes a positive slope. So this happens if you have more than 16.5 quark flavors. And so if you were in a universe with, let's say, 17 quark flavors, then asymptotic freedom would no longer be a valid UV completion for Young-Mills theory. And with this matter content, you would have to find a different UV completion. Now, of course, a similar thing can happen in gravity. So the question is, given any UV completion for gravity, is this actually compatible with standard model degrees of freedom? So, for example, what happens to the fixed point in asymptotic safety under the inclusion of matter degrees of freedom? But in a similar way, what happens if you take, for example, asymptotic freedom in a group field theory and you put matter degrees of freedom in there? Will asymptotic freedom actually persist, or can matter degrees of freedom destroy that? Now, the other direction of the renormalization group flow is, of course, towards the infrared. So let me take the example of quantum electrodynamics. So the microscopic action doesn't have any photon-photon interaction. And within the pure gauge theory, of course, this stays this way all the way to the infrared. Now, as soon as you include matter, in this case, charged fermions, then, of course, you do get this loops with this matter loops with four external fermions, which effectively generate a field strength to the four operator. So the low energy, the Euler-Heisenberg effect of action in QED is then changed. The matter effects contribute a new operator that is not there in the pure gauge theory. And so in a similar way, in quantum gravity, you could ask, well, given a microscopic UV completion, if you follow the renormalization group flow towards the infrared and you take into account the effect of matter, will you actually end up with a low energy effect of action that is consistent with observations, or is the effect of matter fluctuations in your quantum theory of gravity such that you're actually driven away from the domain which is compatible with observations? Now, a third motivation to include matter degrees of freedom into quantum gravity is, of course, that this might be a window into quantum gravity phenomenology. So we all know that experimental data on quantum gravity is really something that is very, very hard to get. And now, depending on whom you ask, it might be completely necessary to have experimental data on quantum gravity to actually make progress. Other people might say, well, it's at least helpful. In any way, any case, it would definitely be useful to have those. And of course, it's somehow unlikely that just by observing pure gravitational dynamics, we will get insight onto quantum gravity. So a route to follow here is, again, that the effects of quantum gravity on matter is potentially something that could be observable. And just to give you a concrete example, I would like to refer back to what Daniel was talking about in his talk. So in settings with large extra dimensions, you can observe the effect of quantum gravity on matter because graviton-mediated scattering processes become enhanced. And then, just to very briefly explain this plot, what you see here is a scattering cross-section. The black curve is the standard model background, and these red curves are results from different quantum gravity models. So you can see that in such a setting, the effect of quantum gravity is as big as the effect of matter in this case. And so you can clearly see quantum gravitational effects here and potentially even distinguish different models. So this is all of the motivation why we should actually take into account matter degrees of freedom in quantum gravity. So let me now jump to a particular model, namely asymptotic safety, and I will be interested in the matter effect on the gravitational fixed point. So this is work in collaboration with Pietro Donna and Roberto Percacci, who are both here. So the truncation of the effect of action that we studied contains an Einstein-Hilbert term and a matter term, and the Einstein-Hilbert term has the bimetric structure that we've heard about so much in previous talks. So just to very, very briefly repeat, the reason for the bimetric structure is essentially because in order to use a renormalization group in gravity, we need to set a scale. We need something that distinguishes high energy and low energy fluctuations. As soon as we have a fluctuating spacetime, it seems that this is a really difficult task. So the route that we take here is a background field method, splitting the metric into a background and a fluctuation. And then, of course, the covariant Laplacian with respect to the background gives us a way to distinguish what are high energy and what are low energy quantum fluctuations. So this way, we set a scale in quantum gravity. But of course, there is no free lunch. So the price that we have to pay is that a certain symmetry of the action under simultaneous shifts of the background and the fluctuation gets broken by this regularization term. And therefore, the couplings of background field and fluctuation field are in general not equal. So therefore, the effect of action that we consider here, or the truncation that we consider, contains a background Newton coupling, a background cosmological constant, and a separate graviton wave function renormalization that is now explicitly distinguished from the background Newton coupling. So these are completely independent couplings. And then there's the set of diagrams that we have to evaluate. And let me just briefly show you the pure gravity results first. So in this truncation, the first good news is, of course, as we've also heard in previous talks, that the fixed point persists under this bimetric truncation. The critical exponents change slightly. They become real, which is why we don't see this spiral in this plot that we've seen in so many plots before. But in general, from this calculation, the conclusion is the fixed point persists. So now the really interesting question is, what happens if we now couple matter? So as a first step, we include minimally coupled matter. We include all the matter that we know experimentally is fundamental matter, namely scalars, Dirac fermions, and vector bosons. And here we restrict ourselves to abelian vector bosons. What we write down here is really just the kinetic terms for the matter fields. They already give us interaction vertices between matter and gravity. And then we include separate wave function renormalizations for the scalar, the Dirac fermion, and the abelian vector boson. And then we do a calculation where we evaluate the beta functions, all the anomalous dimensions. And in the end, we ultimately just ask, what happens to this gravitational fixed point as we vary the number of matter fields? So to first understand what happens, let me show you this perturbative analysis. So there we neglect the wave function renormalizations, and we make a polynomial of expansion of the beta function. And the big advantage that is that the beta function becomes really short, and we can actually understand what happens just by looking at it. So the beta function for the Newton coupling has this term coming from the dimensionality, and then this term here, which is induced by metric and Faraday's Popov ghost fluctuations, which comes with a negative sign. And so therefore, the beta function has the following form. It has a UV attractive interacting fixed point here. This is the fixed point that we know. And let's now include meta degrees of freedom. So they come in the following way: number of scalars plus 2 number of Dirac fermions minus 4 number of vectors. So the first thing to observe is that the vectors come with the same sign as the graviton fluctuations, and therefore you can have arbitrarily many vectors and you will still have a fixed point on the positive line. So let's now fix the number of vectors, as for example in the standard model, and then you can clearly see if you increase the number of scalars and Dirac fermions, at some point you will end up with a straight line, and beyond the beta function will flip and will have an interacting fixed point at a negative value of the Newton coupling. A physical reason, well, it's just what happens if you look at the structure of the vertices and do the loop integrals. So I don't know of any simple reason why you could immediately see this. It's just what the result of the calculation is. So in any case, for beyond the critical number of scalars and Dirac fermions, the fixed point is here at a negative value. And you could say, well, we have now experimental data on quantum gravity in the microscopic regime, so why shouldn't it be UV repulsive? Well, the main point is that in that case, the renormalization group flow would have to take you through a vanishing value of the Newton coupling to a positive Newton coupling in the infrared. And from all that we know, the renormalization group flow cannot cross the barrier G equals zero, and therefore a negative Newton coupling at the fixed point would imply a negative Newton coupling in the infrared. And this is clearly ruled out observationally. And therefore, the case with the fixed point down here is something which is simply excluded. And from that, we conclude that there is an upper limit on the number of scalars and Dirac fermions, and therefore meta-metas in asymptotically safe quantum gravity. So let's now look at the full nonlinear analysis, so going beyond the perturbative analysis I just showed you, and let us include the meta fields one by one. So as a function of scalars, I'm plotting the fixed point values for G and lambda. The main point to see is that there is a sharp increase in the fixed point value for G as the number of scalars. And what you can't see here is that there is a divergence in the fixed point value. And beyond, there is no valid fixed point. So there is an upper number on the upper limit on the number of scalars. The same thing actually holds for fermions. So here I'm plotting the fixed point value for G, the blue dots, and these purple squares is the fixed point value for the cosmological constant. So you see that fermions actually drive you to an anti-de Sitter fixed point. The main point again is that there is a critical number where the fixed point values diverge, and this again gives you an upper limit on the number of scalars and fermions. You can actually see the same thing if you look at the anomalous dimension for the graviton. You see that the effect of fermion fluctuations is to make this increase very sharply until you actually hit a divergence. So this is just microscopically. So this is where the fixed point is. You can then see that the renormalization group flow crosses the lambda equals zero and goes to lambda positive in the infrared. So it doesn't rule out fermions.
So G cannot cross zero, but lambda.
Lambda can, yeah. So interestingly, the behavior of vectors is completely different. So there we don't find an upper limit on their number. We just see that there is an asymptotic behavior as you increase the number of vectors. And in particular, you can then take the limit of the number of vectors going to infinity, and you get a fixed point that really looks like it should be accessible by perturbative tools. So we conclude that the number of vector degrees of freedom is actually unrestricted by the fixed point requirement, at least within our truncation. So now let's come to the full result, including all meta fields at once. So here I'm fixing the number of vectors to 12. This is because this is the interesting number for the standard model. So in the standard model, we have one photon, W plus, W minus Z, and 8 gluons gives us 12 vectors. And then we can look at the number of Dirac fermions and the number of scalars. So this blue curve is the upper limit that we got from the perturbative result. And you see that the full nonlinear non-perturbative result gives you a more complicated shape of the boundary. So all these grayish black plots, points are actually allowed points. So while the shape is actually slightly more complicated, it qualitatively agrees with the perturbative result. And so again, we get an upper limit on the number of Dirac fermions and scalars. Now, of course, we are interested in some very particular meta models, such as, for example, the standard model. So as I said, it has 12 vectors. It has 4 scalars, one of them the propagating Higgs degree of freedom that's been measured, and 3 of them the would-be Goldstone bosons that are eaten up by the W and Zs. Then the standard model is constructed from Weyl fermions, which actually correspond to half a Dirac fermion. And if you count all of them, you actually end up with 45 over 2 Dirac fermions. And so let's look at this plot. So there we are somewhere more or less here in this plane. So this means we are well within the allowed region. And from that, we conclude that asymptotic safety seems to be compatible with a viable gravitational fixed point. So let me comment on the effects of truncations. Of course, since this is the first truncation, we expect that results will change when we increase our truncation. And so I wouldn't really trust anything that lies close to this boundary, but anything that lies well within this region or far out of the region is, I think, something where our truncation can already be trusted. So let us look at a few more specific meta models. So as I said, the standard model is compatible with asymptotic safety. Now, there are a few phenomenologically well-motivated extensions of the standard model. So, for example, neutrino oscillations tell us that there should be right-handed neutrinos. We can add them to the standard model and still get a viable gravitational fixed point. Now, there is also phenomenological evidence for the existence of dark matter. And let's assume that it has a particle physics explanation. Then there's, of course, a wealth of models. A particularly simple one is just adding an additional dark matter scalar. And this is also compatible with the gravitational fixed point. And let me just say, if you're interested in the particle physics side of that model and the question whether you can actually extend that particle physics model all the way up to the Planck scale without the necessity to introduce new degrees of freedom, I would like to refer you to this paper that just came out this morning. Another particle that is phenomenologically quite well motivated is the axion, and this is again something that we can accommodate. Now, of course, people are interested in a wealth of other particle physics models. So what about those? So, for example, a supersymmetric extension is something that has very many scalar degrees of freedom simply because you need to complete the supersymmetric multiplets for the vectors and the Dirac fermions. And this large number of scalars actually implies that we are far out from the allowed region, and within our truncation, it doesn't seem to be compatible with a viable gravitational fixed point. Another model in this class is given by grand unified theories, which again have a huge number of scalars, which brings us far out of the allowed region. And so this means that within our truncation, we actually have only very specific meta models, including the standard model, which are compatible with a viable gravitational fixed point. And I think this is actually really great news because it tells us something about tests of quantum gravity. So the standard folklore is, well, in order to test quantum gravity experimentally, we have to build an accelerator that is the size of the galaxy, so let's just give up now. Well, I would like to say that we can actually potentially test quantum gravity with particle physics experiments that are running currently, such as the LHC at the next energy state of 14 TeV. So let's assume that the LHC finds a wealth of new scalars. This would imply that from our truncation, asymptotic safety seems to be in some sort of danger. So by looking for beyond standard model particle physics at the LHC and also at other experimental searches for further particles, we could actually potentially test quantum gravity. And let me just make a short comment on other models of quantum gravity. Of course, this is all for asymptotic safety, but I would generically assume that if you couple meta degrees of freedom to any ultraviolet completion for gravity, that this will actually potentially change the microscopic gravitational dynamics. And therefore, if you're interested in, for example, GFTs or tensor models or any other kind of model, it could well be that your model turns out to be incompatible with certain kinds of meta models. And therefore, I think the statement that we could potentially test quantum gravity by looking for beyond standard model particle physics actually applies to most quantum gravity models. So another potential test for quantum gravity at the LHC consists in the search for large extra dimensions. So at a first glance, these seem to be compatible with asymptotic safety because the pure gravity fixed point exists in a dimensionality larger than 4. Now, it turns out that if we specify to universal extra dimensions, where all degrees of freedom, including the matter, can propagate into these extra dimensions, then the allowed region in this plane of number of Dirac fermions and scalars shrinks considerably. And already in six dimensions, the standard model is somewhere way out here. And so this seems from that universal extra dimensions is actually something that is in tension with asymptotic safety and the standard model. So in view of time and the coffee break, let me skip this slide. I would now like to briefly comment on a second question. So I've now shown you results from a very specific truncation. What I would like to discuss a little is the general metagravity fixed point structure that we should expect, and that should probably also guide our search for new and better truncations. So in general, I think there are two possible scenarios for the fixed point in asymptotic safety. So one case is that it's a gravity-dominated fixed point, which means that in the schematic plot of gravity couplings and metacouplings, the fixed point lies somewhere where the metacouplings vanish and the gravitational couplings are non-vanishing. And this has also been called a Gaussian meta fixed point. Now, possibly from the fact that many standard model couplings actually tend to be asymptotically free in the UV, you could assume that maybe this gravity-dominated fixed point is the scenario that would be realized in asymptotic safety. Now, the second scenario is clearly one where all the couplings, metacouplings, and gravity couplings are non-vanishing, and so we have a fully interacting gravity-matter fixed point. So what I would like to argue is that the second option actually seems to be the one that is realized in asymptotic safety. And the mechanism for that is really rather simple. So the main point is that as soon as you couple matter to gravity, even starting with the free theory, quantum gravity fluctuations will induce matter interactions, which have to be non-vanishing at the gravitational fixed point. So the mechanism is very simple. Let's just write down a free matter theory, for example, a scalar theory. Then, of course, this does already have vertices which couple the matter field to gravity. And this means I can form these diagrams, which are driven by metric fluctuation and which have a certain number of external matter legs. And if I look at them in detail and analyze their structure, then the momentum dependence of these vertices implies that the induced interactions here will, of course, be four scalar interactions with a particular momentum dependence. And I would like to call the corresponding coupling rho. So now what happens is that these diagrams, of course, enter the beta function for that matter self interaction. Of course, that beta function in general is something that is a function of further matter couplings, and that has the structure that if you set that matter coupling, that coupling rho to zero, then it will just stay zero. But now the gravitational contributions give you some new contribution to the beta function, which is just proportional to the Newton coupling, and this is a constant that depends on the choice of regularization. So in some sense, this is not unknown from effective field theory, where we know that, of course, fluctuations of a field always induce further interactions in the effective theory. What is a little different here is that this is actually something that happens towards the ultraviolet. So since in asymptotic safety, the Newton coupling is non-vanishing, it means that even if I set that self-interaction to zero, its beta function will be non-vanishing. And now if I'm looking for a fixed point, such as an asymptotic safety, then this means that rho equals zero is simply not a viable fixed point, but the fixed point value of this matter coupling will actually be non-zero, so matter will be interacting at the fixed point. So let me show this same thing again, just using a plot. So this is a schematic plot of the beta function for this matter self-interaction. The blue line is the case without gravity, where we do have a Gaussian fixed point. So without gravity, if I set that coupling to zero, it will remain zero. Now what happens if I switch on metric fluctuations is that they shift this beta function in such a way that there is no interacting fixed point. There will only be a non-interacting fixed point. And now, of course, what happens is that as soon as you've switched on momentum-dependent matter self-interactions, they will again couple back into something like the flow of the effective potential for that scalar, and then you will also get non-vanishing fixed point values for that scalar potential. And so I would conclude from that first study within these truncations that the fixed point structure in asymptotic safety is actually one where quantum gravity and matter are interacting and all couplings are non-vanishing. And of course, this implies that this is a structure that we should also take into account in future truncations. So let me come to my summary and outlook. So I argued that matter does actually matter in asymptotically safe quantum gravity, and I think similar studies could, even if they are probably very challenging from a calculational point, but they could also be done in other models of quantum gravity and would presumably also produce some similar results. What this means is that experimental tests of quantum gravity can actually become possible by looking for beyond standard model particle physics at experiments such as the LHC. And finally, in the case of asymptotic safety, it seems that the metagravity fixed point is one that is fully interacting. And this, of course, means that there is a wealth of structure that remains to be explored. And with that, I would like to thank you for your attention.
There's something I don't understand about your master formula with the scalar and fermionic contribution.
Mm-hmm.
So supersymmetry is set up in a way that you cancel fermionic and bosonic loops. That means NS and NV should come with different signs. But in your computation, NV and NS come with the same sign.
So this is also exactly the same result that you get out from a perturbative calculation. So people like, for example, Xavier Calmet have done that, and they actually find precisely the same coefficients here. So in general, it's difficult to just understand these signs from just looking at the type of meta field, because you know the interaction vertices are complicated, and so the sign is just determined from evaluating them. And so I don't think there's any way how you could simply say, well, we know it's a fermion, so it has to come with a negative sign for an arbitrary beta function. That's simply not true, because it depends on the structure of the vertex that you put in.
You mentioned that if you take the number of vectors to be very large, mm-hmm. G star fixed point would be very small.
Yeah.
So it would be in the perturbative regime.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, it seems that perturbative gravity doesn't see any kind of fixed point. So it seems to me that there is some tension or
convergence. Well, but this is, I mean, by perturbative gravity, you mean just gravitational fluctuations in a perturbative setting. But what this is the large end limit where you just have vector degrees of freedom and you ignore gravitational fluctuations. And so I think from this structure, you would conclude that you can do a perturbative calculation of just vector loops looking at their contribution to the gravitational beta functions, and you should see that fixed point at a small value of g.
In perturbative gravity.
I think that from this you can potentially conclude that, although you have to be careful, there is a non-vanishing value of the cosmological constant here, and there is also a relatively large anomalous dimension. So it's not necessarily clear if this is really a fully perturbative fixed point.
Well, it cannot be a fully perturbative.
Because of the, Well, but I mean, so this is also within a truncation, so it's not clear what will happen to the value of eta if you go beyond the truncation. Yeah, but yeah. Well, no, I mean, in principle, you simply write this action down with field binds. So you simply evaluate everything with field binds, and then the only point is that it's actually convenient to translate field bind fluctuations into metric fluctuations, which you can do, but there's really no problem at all with evaluating those diagrams.
Just a quick, I like that you said that you can actually test then the scenario looking for the existence of extra particles, but maybe I guess that would need also some handles on the effect of the truncation. Mm-hmm. What you said concerns the isolated truncation. Do you plan to go beyond to try to see if qualitatively
yes,
stays the same? Do you expect big changes, or do you have an argument to say that
so as I said, I wouldn't trust anything that lies close to our boundary too much, but I would say anything that lies very far within that region or far outside is actually something which you should be able to trust within the truncation, but we are working on extensions. So I think their essential point is that if you have a negative gravitational contribution to the scalar self-interaction, then in principle this gives you a handle on predictions for the Higgs mass. Now it turns out that within that whole plane where we see fixed points, if you evaluate that particular contribution to the scalar self-interaction, then you also you always do find the sign that would allow for this construction to go through. But of course, I think what you have to take into account potentially is the structure of the induced matter-self interactions and see how this affects that prediction. Yeah.
So, how do you imagine a world where we don't have this ultraviolet speed quantum? It's still a possible model of the world. I mean, we suppose the supersymmetry was there.
Mm-hmm.
So then there's not this ultraviolet speed quantum.
Yes.
But are you then saying that there's no gravity field theory as such? It doesn't exist? Or how should one think about it?
I think taking this very seriously would rule out the asymptotic safety scenario. But of course, there are a number of further things that you can consider, such as, for example, upgrading to full supergravity, and then you have the effect of gravitinos, and we're working on that. So I have no idea what the full picture would be, and also there's one thing, of course, since you can always have an arbitrary large number of vector degrees of freedom, and what vectors actually do is that they increase these allowed regions here. In principle, you could have a model which has supersymmetry discovered at the LHC, and then a number of further vector degrees of freedom at very high scales, which actually enlarge this region so that this model with supersymmetry plus additional vectors would become compatible.
So, well, maybe I should thank you to everyone. To come back to your question, I mean, of course, conceivably, you could be living in a world in which this constant remains an irrelevant coupling, and the universality of the description of the effective field theory is just very limited, computed by some one of your favorite tensor networks or something like that.
Well, then there should be a new model of gravity. This is what it's
Yeah.
So some kind of basis to something else.
Yeah, see, that's what you mean by patient.
Some different degrees of freedom.
Okay,
so let's thank Astrid again.